Hey, it's Joe. Today on episode 159, I am joined by Bob Sibohar, who came recommended to me, and get this, as the most respected endurance sports dietitian. Bob is rather famous for the development of his metabolic efficiency program. Actually, many years ago, well before the whole Zone 2 thing came about, Bob's approach is very different. Of course, everybody has heard of metabolic flexibility, the idea of wanting to be able to burn glucose and be able to burn fat and be able to switch between them easily, as we could in our youth. Bob discovered that he needed to teach his own body, and now has learned how to teach the bodies of many other athletes how to not just be able to switch between them and burn each efficiently, but to teach the body when to switch for not just optimal athletic performance, but optimal health. I thought that that would be very interesting to you, as it was to me. All right, let's talk to Bob Sibohar about metabolic efficiency. Bob Sibohar, welcome to the Wise Athletes Podcast.
Joe, I am enamored and so honored to be on your podcast today. I cannot wait to chat.
Awesome. Well, hey, thanks for that. I appreciate that. Hey, I got to also tell you something else that I think you're going to like. You come very highly recommended. Tavis Patoli, who works with the team over at Omega Quant, the Dr. Harris group, he told me, and I'm going to read it here because it's so good. Bob is who I consider the most respected endurance sports dietitian in our field.
That goes a long way. I mean, thank you, Tavis. He's a good colleague and friend of mine. But, you know, it's interesting because I feel like nutrition, let's just say sport nutrition, as you know, Joe, it can get very diluted and very confusing, right? So, no, I love that. I take that to heart. I appreciate that comment.
Well, good. We're going to give you a chance to show your stuff here.
Yeah.
And as always, we're constrained on time here. You know, I want 20 years of knowledge and experience in an hour.
Okay. So let's give
our audience a little bit of background. Where did this come from? You know, what's your experience? And I'll put some more stuff in the show notes so people can find out more about you. But give us a little bit, you know, the elevator pitch.
Yeah, for sure. And I won't go long-winded. I think it's more important to understand where the whole metabolic efficiency training concept came from. But just so your listeners know, they're just not talking to a, you know, bozo clown or whatever. I have been doing this for quite some time. I've got 3 college degrees. I actually started in exercise physiology and strength and conditioning, and went back into nutrition. And that's going to become important here, as you'll see. This is why I say this. But really, I mean, I've been doing this. I've been a sport dietitian for 27 years. I've been in this field for 30, because I did, like I said, a lot of exercise physiology testing and training and strength and conditioning before. But, you know, I love to blend the physiology with the nutrition. And that's unfortunately something that's been missing quite a bit for athletes in sport nutrition. They just look at the nutrition side and not really both.
Right. Yeah, and we're going to get into the details on that. But a little on your background. 3 college degrees.
3 college degrees, yes. So I've got an undergrad in exercise and sports science, and then I've got a master's degree in health and exercise science with a little bit more of an emphasis on metabolism. And then my second master's degree, it almost was a PhD, but I decided not to. My second master's degree was actually food science and human nutrition, and that was so I could become a registered dietitian. Registered dietitian is very different than a nutritionist, because we have schooling, we have internships, we have certain things that we need to take care of every year in terms of continuing education. So,
all right. So more rigor in that.
I'm legit.
Well, good. That's good to know.
Yeah.
Since I'm going to be listening to what you say and modifying health and fitness protocols on that basis. You also, just real quick, you have some credentials in terms of like other places you have contributed your expertise.
You're talking about like institutions kind of thing?
Yeah.
So I've been around since, you know, graduating and navigating that world. I've worked in private practice before. I've worked in sports medicine clinics. I did a short stint at the University of Florida as their director of sport nutrition, and was going to stay there, but moved over to the U.S. Olympic Committee way back when. That's actually, I was one of the 3 first sport dietitians that the U.S. Olympic Committee had ever hired. Wow. So was kind of part of that movement, which is pretty cool. Currently, I own my own practice, which is called Energy Performance, but I'm also the consulting sport dietitian for the Las Vegas Golden Knights professional hockey team. And I'm also the consulting dietitian for the entire University of Denver athletics program. So I've got my hand in a few different pots.
Yeah, you must be a busy fella.
I'm a little busy, you know.
Yeah, so thanks for giving me an hour here. I want to make the most of it. So let's get into it. Metabolic efficiency, that's sort of your thing.
Yeah.
Now that's probably going to sound very familiar to people. People are going to be thinking, wait, I know a little bit about that. I've been hearing about zone two and that's like some metabolic efficiency kind of stuff. And then also, you know, the fat adapted, you know, the Phil Maffetone kind of a thing some years ago. But what you're talking about is where you're like combining the exercise protocols with the diet protocols in order to, you know, have a maximum effect. Am I understanding that right?
Yeah, that's a good short way of putting it for sure. And I'll just say, I'll follow that up with, there's a lot of confusion these days around just that term metabolic efficiency or metabolic efficiency training. I label it as metabolic efficiency training because it is actually a series of training protocols, both exercise and nutrition based, that can literally, see, here's the thing with metabolic efficiency training. You can teach your body to burn more fat and thus store more carbohydrates. Or you can do the exact opposite and train your body to burn more carbohydrate and store more fat.
Yeah, one of those sounds better than the other.
I know, right? Exactly. Most of your listeners are going to be like, duh, like, why wouldn't we want to burn more fat? And I only say that because I actually have worked with a handful of athletes that actually are on the side of, you know what, I don't care about fat storage. Like, these are our young guns, you know, young guys and gals who are like, hey, I can do anything, a bulletproof.
With very good insulin sensitivity.
Exactly, right? So yeah, perhaps at a younger age, although I would argue the statement I'm going to say, perhaps at a younger age, it is okay to burn more carbohydrate and store more fat. But what I've noticed as a sport dietitian for certain sports that are very anaerobic based, so think hockey, think gymnastics, think very just like weightlifting, powerlifting, right? That just has those bursts of energy. Perhaps, but the other 99% of us, listen, we have to teach our body to burn more fat and preserve more carbohydrate for not only performance reasons. And listen, I actually did not start this concept for any real health reasons. It was only performance, but health is a huge limiter to performance, as we know, right? You can't be healthy if you can't perform if you're not healthy. Mm-hmm. But also, I just want to make it clear that, listen, you know, as we age, especially as we're over 40, right? We have to pay more attention to certain things, don't we, Joe? Like our nutrition, our recovery.
You're not kidding.
Yeah. You mentioned insulin sensitivity, which we can get into later. But yeah, I mean, we need to stop following diets and start periodizing our nutrition to support our health, longevity, and performance goals.
Yeah.
That's my elevator speech.
Okay. That's a good one. And the young guy, the young Joe, me being a young person, what I didn't appreciate, and maybe this is the young person syndrome, is you just don't appreciate that, you know, if you did something and you felt fine afterwards, that doesn't mean it had no negative effect on you. Mm-hmm. These little negative things can accumulate over time, and you don't realize it until, oops, too late.
Yeah. And yeah, to your point, until you get tests, like you do some blood work testing, do some genetic testing, do some metabolic efficiency testing, you're like, wait a second, why are these things off, right? That's, you know, I have another saying, I've got a lot of sayings, which you'll probably hear, but one of them is test, don't guess, right? So stop guessing, like have some things measured, because we live in a society where we can have just about everything measured. I mean, it might not be efficacious, but we can have it measured. And I'm all for testing as long as we use the data.
Sure, sure. Yeah. And by efficacious, you mean cost effective. Exactly. It might not be worth the money, but you can learn some stuff.
Totally.
Okay. So here's what I thought we would do is we get into this metabolic efficiency training.
Yes.
Because we all want to be metabolically efficient, right?
Yeah.
I have had another guest on a couple of times who talks about metabolic flexibility.
Yes, yes.
That's connected to this efficiency. I think that by efficiency, what we mean is not just that you're able to use different fuels and switch between them, but that your body knows which fuels to use when.
Exactly. And that you can teach your body to use the fuels. That's the thing.
Yeah,
like metabolic flexibility is being able to switch. It's like a light switch, like on, off, like going back and forth. That's very important, especially for health. But yeah, but the metabolic efficiency is actually doing things to train or teach your body to have those effects.
And I think that what you're going to tell us, just based on listening to your talks, is that there's a teaching part that is kind of a euphemism maybe for giving your body the signals that it needs to develop the capacity to do what you want it to do. But there's the other side of it is you can kind of hack it too, right? What you eat that day
Oh,
has an
yeah.
effect on how your body functions that day. So
Yes.
pick your poison, man.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And that's, it's a good point because I often tell athletes this. I'm like, and we could talk about this down the road too, but just because of digestion works differently, right? But what you eat today actually affects today and tomorrow, and maybe even the next day, just because the digestive rate is usually, from entry to exit, which we don't talk about too graphically, but it's usually a couple of days, right? So yeah, there's some things we need to think about there.
Okay, so again, just in the sake of time, here's what I thought we would do. We talk a little bit about why does this matter? You
Yes.
know, one of the reasons is GI upset
Yep.
during long events or even races where maybe it really matters that you're sort of really trying to cram the energy into your system and you're going to be
Yeah.
going long enough that you really have got to do that, or you might run out if you're a glucose burner. But then there's other things to do, and some of them are short term and some of them are long term. And I think it's worth getting them out on the table. We can't spend 30 minutes on this topic, but we ought to get 5 or 10 minutes of why is it important. And then maybe we ought to talk a little bit about, well, how does the body choose between it's going to burn fat or it's going to burn glucose? Because I think that some of that sort of sets you up for then understanding, well, what can you do about it? But
Right.
then I thought we'd talk about how does a person know if they could do better? And I know that you've got a testing protocol and it'd be worth understanding what that is. But I think that for the audience, you know, if they're really interested in getting testing, well, they know who to get in touch with and we'll give them all that contact info
For
in
sure.
the at the end. You can share it and I'll put it in the show notes also. But you know, for a person who's not, you know, maybe they're not racing and they're not really looking for that 99th percentile, they just want to get better. You know, how can they tell? Are they bonking all the time? What are the obvious signals that you know that they could do better? And then we could move into, okay, what's the program? You know, how do you do this? You know, what's the exercise part of it? What's the diet part of it? How does it work together? And then, you know, we'll just go into, I've got a million questions. So we won't run out of questions. We will run out of
Yeah,
time.
for sure, for sure. So
All right.
would it be okay if I provided the history first and
Yeah,
I'll go quick? Okay. Because
go.
I think it's important for everyone to understand like where did this come from, right?
Sure.
So this was literally in the early 2000s, and this is when I was making my transition as a competitive soccer player growing up to an endurance athlete when I was in my undergrad and started dabbling in running and triathlons. The history is as I moved from team sport, very more aerobic based, into more aerobic based endurance, I found that I was having a lot of GI distress. And you name the flavor, whatever, like, yes, vomiting, diarrhea, bloating, everything, right?
You mean distress while you were exercising or?
Yes,
Oh,
while I
okay.
was running or biking, it was just like, wow, something like I've never had that before, right? A lot of team sport athletes never have this until you move to endurance. And this is kind of what set up my career and kind of why I specialized with endurance athletes, because I was one of them. I was trying to learn the sport back then. But I was also helping a lot of endurance athletes. And interestingly enough, Joe, a lot of them were complaining about the same things. I'm like, wait a second, is this normal? And actually, I would ask a lot of my professors and my mentors back then, and saying the same thing, and they would say, oh yeah, that's part of the equation of being an endurance athlete. And I really didn't like that. One, because if you've ever had GI distress, you never want to have it again. It's horrible. So what I did was I went back to the research. I went back to biochem, metabolism, exercise, phys, nutrition, anything. And I was just trying to ask the question, like, can anything be done to eliminate GI distress? Okay. And I won't go too winded or too long-winded in this, but I actually re-found the crossover concept. And this is an exercise physiology concept, which basically describes the body's efficiency at using fat and using carbohydrate at different intensities of exercise. So, and I remember I learned about this in like probably my sophomore year, forgot about it because you don't remember any of that stuff, right? So I revisit, I'm like, oh, this is interesting. So if we burn fat and carbohydrate at different intensities or more fat, more carbohydrate, different intensities. What if we introduce a different nutrition intervention? Because at that time, I was kind of getting into my master's degree in nutrition, looking a lot more at the biochemistry, metabolism. But here's what I found. All the research that was done on, let's just call it fat burning and carbohydrate burning, the interventions were only exercise-based. So I don't go to the health club or gyms anymore, but you know when we used to, and I don't know if you do, Joe, but you go on a treadmill or a stair climber or stair whatever, and you see those little fat burning charts, those zones that are very colorful. This is actually where this came from. So this research said, as long as you exercise, here comes the exercise part, as long as you exercise under 65% of your max intensity, which
is
could
by heart rate.
Could be heart rate, could be VO2 max. Nobody knows their VO2 max, right? Well, not nobody, but more heart rate based. So if the basic, the researcher said, as long as you're under 65% max heart rate, you're going to burn more fat. So I looked at that and I said, okay, great. But I also know that if we introduce different macronutrients, carb, protein, fat at different ratios, because I was Mr. Smarty Pants going to grad school, I was like, well, wait a second, that actually utilizes and metabolizes differently. So maybe this is the answer. You know, I was kind of hypothesizing back then, null hypothesis, like maybe if we change nutrition, it will change the point at which our body burns fat and carbohydrate. So what I was doing was I was trying to challenge the norm. And obviously the answer is yes, you can. If you change your nutrition, you can change your body's ability to burn fat or store fat, like I introduced earlier. But my whole focus was trying to get rid of GI distress. So I won't go down that rabbit hole because there are much more interesting things to talk about with metabolic efficiency training, but that's the history. So when I came through and I said, oh, you know, again, using the exercise physiologist in me, I actually developed the testing protocol for this so I could actually measure if I manipulate an athlete's diet, what does that do to their fat burning or carbohydrate burning? And lo and behold, I found out that if you change the different ratios of carb, protein, and fat, you can favor more or less fat burning. Okay. Voila, here we have the metabolic efficiency training concept. And guess what? Here's the other cool thing. You can actually, we don't have to be relegated to saying, oh, we only burn more fat under 65% max heart rate. That's not true anymore. We've got research to prove that, not just my real life testing over thousands of athletes. We actually have research to state that we can actually teach our body to burn more fat up to 87% intensity, which is crazy, right?
So 87% of what?
Max heart rate.
Max heart rate. Wow, that's pretty high.
Let's put this in zones, right? So zone one, zone two is typically the quote unquote fat burning zone, right? We've all heard it before, which is true, right? It's absolutely true. You improve your mitochondrial density, biogenesis, absolutely. But what we're talking about now is the ability to burn more fat in zone three and zone four.
Yeah.
And that is exciting because now it doesn't limit our training. And that's the cool part, right? Because traditionally in the past, if someone wanted to, you know, burn more fat, they were relegated to just doing zone one, zone two training.
Wow.
But I've disproved that. And I've shown, and as research has, that we can actually increase our intensity while actually burning more fat. But here's the thing, as you know, you need to teach your body to do that first.
Okay. To summarize a little bit there, and then let's get into it. You wanted to figure out a way to need to eat less food while you were exercising, so that you would not have distress.
Exactly.
You know, digestive distress.
Exactly.
From the eating of all the food that you were trying to eat.
Yes.
And you figured you could do that by teaching your body to burn all the fat stores. And even a skinny person has plenty of fat in their body,
plenty of fat,
a day's worth of exercise. So if you could burn more fat and need less food, then you could eat less, still do the workout, and not have to, you know, run for a bush every mile.
Exactly. Yeah. And still be efficient with your workout, like still maintain your performance.
Right. Right. Yeah. 87% is sort of amazing. I want to understand that better when we get into it. That would be like me, like 150 some, you know, 100, low 150s heart rate.
Right.
And that's when I'm burning fat.
It's like, wow, man, because that's like, that's a hard workout for me. So I'm obviously a sugar burner, at least a little bit.
Yes.
Let's jump in here. Oh, and another thing to point out that you didn't say it, and probably most people know, but just in case, you're not saying that you're either burning fat or you're burning glucose.
Correct.
It's a ratio, and you're probably always burning a little of something, you know, both.
Yes.
But it's at the extremes where you're burning very little. If you're doing a VO2 max test and you're just about to vomit, you're not burning a lot of fat doing that.
Yeah.
And down at the other end, if you're just walking around the neighborhood, if you're healthy, you're probably not burning a lot of glucose. But there are individual variations on that. And people who are unhealthy, people who are metabolically inefficient, they don't fit those molds. But in general, just it's a gradient that switches. And this crossover is when you move from burning 51% fat to where it's 51% glucose. And then it, you know, just keeps separating from that point.
That's exactly it.
Let's get into, why does it matter? Okay, so one way it matters is that you don't have to eat so much food while you're, you know, if you're going to do an 8-hour bike ride, you know, you're going to do the triple bypass and it's going to be a 14-hour, 120-mile ride. You're going to run out of energy if you don't eat something.
Yeah.
But if you've got to eat a turkey dinner at every rest station, you're not going to feel that good.
Exactly.
So that's one benefit of being able to burn more fat. What else? What are some of the other benefits that you discovered after figuring this out so that you could stop eating so much?
Yeah, that was the interesting thing, right? So then I went to, okay, now I've pretty much fixed GI distress in myself and other athletes. And then it was funny because then I started doing more testing with myself and other athletes. I did blood work testing. And here's what I was noticing. Fasting blood sugar was reducing. Fasting insulin was was being reduced. So now we're talking about being more insulin sensitive, which is good, and not pre-diabetic. And then I saw with athletes who were having like blood lipid issues, so cholesterol problems, maybe family history or whatever, now we were actually manipulating blood lipids. So the goods were going up and the bads were going down. Nice. So all of a sudden I'm like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. So we've got that in talking about health and longevity. Okay, great. You know, we want to, hopefully you want to be on this earth for a few more years. The other thing was it was actually, and it still does, helps actually increase the body's success in reducing body fat and promoting better weight loss success. So because it's not, here's the thing, and I slipped once, I apologize. I usually don't say the word diet. Metabolic efficiency training, there's no diet there because it's a lifestyle pattern that should be periodized based on your health goals, your longevity goals, and your performance goals. So there may be times where you increase or decrease carbohydrate or protein or fat, but that's the beauty. So now we're looking at performance. We're looking at GI, you know, elimination of GI distress. We're looking at improving health markers, insulin sensitivity, blood sugar regulation. And here's the other thing. Everything that I do with metabolic efficiency training is stemmed in the foundation is optimizing blood sugar. Now, if you just do a quick blood or a quick Google search on why does blood sugar matter? Blood sugar affects just about every system in your body, including the cognitive system, so the brain. So now we're getting into thought, decisiveness, even I'm not going to go out on saying preventing any diseases, but blood sugar optimization is a part of dementia, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's. So now we're reaching much more than just moving our bodies through sport.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, you know, for me and a lot of my audience, the fitness and the exercise, that's like a part of having a good life. And the fact that that's good for your health, that's great.
Yeah.
But some of my audience are people, they're not really athletes. They exercise for their health. So this is speaking directly to those people of, well, here's how to do it right so that you're getting the maximum benefit for your health. So that's great. Exactly. Let's shift into, how does the body choose between, is it going to burn more fat or is it going to burn more glucose? You know, just give us the high points here.
Yeah. So it's a good point. And most of it is driven by hormones, right? So when we eat food, different hormones will be signaled to kind of shuttle that food, call it carbohydrate, protein, or fat, to where they need to go, right? So from a very simplistic view, when we eat carbohydrates, they will get broken down through glycolysis. They'll go through Krebs. I mean, everything, pyruvate, lactate, all this stuff. We break down carbohydrates to get immediate energy, but then we'll store those in the muscle, in the liver, and then there's a little bit of carbohydrates floating around in the blood. When we eat protein, we don't necessarily, we break down protein. It's called denaturing, and we denature it. We kind of rip the protein apart into the different amino acids, and we store amino acids in our, in different parts of our body. We don't store it as protein. We store it as amino acids because all these things do different, all the amino acids do different things in the body. When we eat fat, interestingly enough, now it depends on the type of fat, and we won't go down that rabbit hole, but we will either utilize that fat if the hormones are primed and if our carbohydrate intake is proper, let's call it that, which we'll get to. And then we actually, like, then the fat can either be used as energy, or it's, yes, going to be stored in adipose tissue or intra-abdominal tissue. So we've got a lot of different mechanisms, but most of it is driven by hormones, to be honest with you. But here's the cool thing. The ratio of carbohydrate to protein will dictate how your blood sugar is regulated. And I kind of feel like this is the next step, and I'm going to ask the question for you because I'm just going to answer it. Who cares, right? Who cares about blood sugar regulation? This is why we care. When you do not eat enough protein, and let me back up real quick, Joe. For your listeners, if they are vegan or vegetarian, I get it. I feel for you. I used to be there for 10 years of my life. But if you are an omnivore, this is going to become much more clear to you. The protein that you eat as an omnivore is usually animal-based protein, right? And most animal-based proteins have fat in them. Mm-hmm. So I am purposely leaving fat out of my discussion because the assumption is that you are an omnivore and you will have fat in the protein.
Okay.
I just needed to qualify that.
Okay.
Now, moving on with my story, it's all about the ratio of carbohydrates to protein that you eat every meal or snack that actually has an effect on your blood sugar. So let me give you an easy example. I always use it with my athletes. If you eat a banana, which is all carbohydrate, your blood sugar will spike very quickly, right? It's immediate energy. Your blood sugar spikes. You'll feel great for about 10 to 15 minutes. You have enough energy. But then it's like a roller coaster. You will drop hard, right? You get that kind of that hangry feeling. You've got to eat something again. Well, that has negative consequences for our health and our body composition and our body weight and GI distress, right? And here's why. A little bit of a science lesson. When your blood sugar is high because there's not enough protein to and fat, but protein to help the carbohydrate have a blunted response versus a spike response, when blood sugar is high, the pancreas secretes insulin. Insulin is a great hormone because one of its functions is to come in, identify that there's high blood sugar, and bring that high blood sugar down. Because if you walk around with high blood sugar, that is a pre-diabetic or a diabetic state, and we don't want anybody there, right? So, great. This is, of course, assuming that you are insulin sensitive and your pancreas, the beta cells, specifically the pancreas, are not destroyed or dysfunctional. Okay, so high blood sugar, high insulin. Insulin brings blood sugar down. We move on throughout our day. But the story doesn't end there because when this is the kicker. This is where your listeners are like, wait a second, I got to listen to what he says now. When insulin is high, it just about turns off the body's ability to burn fat through different enzymatic reactions.
Fat that's in your body already or fat that you just ate?
No, fat that's in your body. That's the thing, right? So if I eat my banana and my blood sugar is high, insulin is high, that banana is actually turning off my body's ability to burn my internal stores of fat as energy. So when you eat more carbohydrates without protein, just carbs on their own, and I'm not talking about exercise, I'm talking about meals and snacks, right? If I just have a banana for a snack, I'm actually turning on my ability to burn carbohydrate and turning off my ability to burn fat.
Okay.
Now, if that's your goal, so be it. But, you know, 99.9% of the athletes I work with, that's not their goal. We want to burn more fat.
Right.
So What could we do in my example? You put peanut butter with your banana, because what does peanut butter have? Protein and fat. So the whole goal is to try to balance, yeah, I use that word in, you know, air quotes, balance your macronutrients, protein, carb, fat, to where your blood sugar doesn't spike, because we don't want an insulin spike, because this whole game is actually about controlling insulin. Because high insulin decreases fat burning on the inside of our body, we want to control insulin levels.
And when you're exercising, I understand that your body doesn't make as much insulin, because that's the exactly muscle right. is going to pull the glucose directly in to the muscle right. to use for fuel.
Yeah. And that's the beautiful part about exercise. Again, we're assuming in a non-diabetic state, right? So let's put that out there. So like non-diabetic individuals, when they exercise actually suppresses insulin release. So we're good. We're good when we exercise, because the muscles very much enjoy that glucose and they can dispose of that glucose very easily without any blood sugar spikes. So it's just outside of exercise where we're very concerned about the regulation and the optimization of blood sugar.
All right. And another thing, which I guess is, I don't know, I think that it's understood, is that your history, you know, we were just talking about, you know, acute, you know, I just ate a banana, now I'm having an effect of that. But if you're always eating high glycemic things, then that's changing your body. Your body adapts to expect that and be efficient with that. And then if you start eating fat, your body's not ready for that. Just like if like a keto person and you're fat adapted, quote unquote, and then you try to eat carbs right before your race so that you can have some jet fuel, your body is not good at that. It doesn't have the enzymes that it would normally have if you had been eating carbohydrates regularly, even at a lower level over time. So there's some like long-term effect of your, you know, mm-hmm. eating patterns, isn't there?
There absolutely is. And you nailed it. I mean, that's why, I mean, in certain cases, I might recommend a lower carbohydrate, higher fat, you know, quote unquote diet for health reasons, but you nailed it. Like if athletes stay on a keto or an LCHF, low carb, high fat, quote unquote diet too long, you exactly hit the nail right on the head. There's an enzyme called PDH, pyruvate dehydrogenase, that becomes very inefficient or very ineffective when you're not eating a lot of carbohydrates. So if you need more carbohydrate, you have to teach the body, you have to teach that enzyme to work efficiently again. And that's why, like, if someone is doing a keto or an LCHF diet and racing, you want to allow like at least 3 to 4 weeks of titrating, like getting more carbohydrate back in your nutrition plan before your event, so your body can be efficient with that again.
Got it. Okay. Just for the sake of time, let's just move on. We'll just conclude by saying that lots of things affect how your body decides what fuels to burn in a given moment.
Right.
To some extent is controllable by you in the short run and some in other ways in the long run, but it has an effect on not just your athletic performance, it has an effect on your health. So this is why this is important beyond just, you know, GI distress.
I would say the majority of the importance that I teach is the health and longevity, to be honest with you, because we are, as aging athletes, masters athletes, we all want to continue doing something in our later years, right? Sure. And this is helping us do that.
right. Yeah. We got to be a healthy person in order to be a good athlete as we get older. And you want to live a long time and be a strong athlete for a long time. Well, you better have a good health foundation, as you said at the beginning.
Exactly.
All right. So let's move into this question of, well, how does a person know? I mean, aside from getting a metabolic efficiency test, which is probably the best way to do it, you know, what are some of the clues that people might have? I mean, one way might be that they're pre-diabetic, you know, that their A1C is, you know, 5.9 or 6 something or worse than that. What would you say?
Yeah, that's actually great. And let's just segment that. So quantitative and qualitative. Okay. So quantitative, the only true way to know if you are metabolically efficient or efficient at using your stored fat and stored carbohydrate, is by doing having done a metabolic efficiency test. Now, the good news is, I do it here in Colorado, but I actually certify a lot of health professionals around the world that also have testing centers. So it's becoming easier to find that, but we're not talking about that. Let's talk about the qualitative or the subjective. And not so much subjective, because HbA1c or fasting glucose, those won't determine if you're metabolically efficient. Those will just determine if we have some some problems that we need to address, right? So more of the subjective that you can really, your audience members, listeners can really hold on to is, okay, here's one thing. Do you get hangry or tired between 1 and 4 p.m.? If yes, you are most likely not optimizing your blood sugar. You're most likely more of a sugar burner. And that is why you're feeling that crash between 1 and 4 p.m. So if you're going for sugar or caffeine during that time, that is a clear sign that you are not metabolically efficient. Okay.
All right, good.
Another thing is you can't, and while there are hormones involved in this also, so it's not the only thing, if you've tried to lose weight or body comp, because listen, we all know as we get older, that's harder to get off of us. We know this, right? But if you're having major issues with that, it could be, part of the problem could be that you are simply not regulating your blood sugar as well. Because remember I said earlier, hormones are actually involved in this also, specifically glucagon and insulin. But not to mention, I mean, obviously for females, estrogen, progesterone, males, testosterone, we've got our thyroid hormones. So if you're just kind of like, yeah, I've been trying to lose weight or I'm having the stubborn body fat around my hips or my stomach, it could be because you're not metabolically efficient. Another thing for those who are training, if you are finding that the obvious one is if you have GI distress, we need to get you metabolically efficient because nobody needs to live with that during exercise. Like it's not necessary. It's not normal. I just want to put that out there. Another thing during exercise is if, you know, we've got these guidelines, research tells us how many grams of carbohydrate we should eat per hour during exercise or how many calories, doesn't matter if you're, which one you use. If you're finding that you're needing to eat a lot of calories and you are not a professional athlete, you are not metabolically efficient. And I don't have a number, but I usually use somewhere around, if you're consuming over 2 to 250 calories an hour and you're not professional, we probably need to look at your metabolic efficiency because you don't, you need to teach your body to use more of its fat stores as energy. I mean, you don't need to consume all of those, I'm just guessing, simple sugars during exercise, right? I mean, can you? Sure. Do you have to? No. Let's make the body more efficient.
And maybe along those lines, I know people who, if they don't eat something, they're going to bonk.
Oh, totally.
And that is like the worst feeling in the world. It's exactly what a heart attack feels like, is what I'm told. And I have bonked twice in my life. And I thought I was dying. I mean, I had to get off the stationary bike and I had to lay on the floor while I was freezing and sweating and breathing. And, you know, it was like, this is bad. Yeah. What is happening to me? So you don't want that. But other people, they bonk all the time.
All the time.
And that's got to be a sign that you're a sugar burner.
99%. Yeah. I mean, aside from any disease states or prevailing conditions. Yeah. 99%. It's because they have not taught, they're more efficient at using carbs, which by the way, let's go down that road in a second. They're more efficient at using carbs and storing fat. Here's where the road I want to go down really quick. Listen, this is basic biochemistry. When you eat carbohydrates, you burn carbohydrates very quickly. It's a very bad, inefficient circle because the more carbs you eat, the more you burn, the more you want to eat, and the more you're going to bonk, right? Because you don't, we actually didn't introduce this, Joe. I apologize for this. The normal body, the normal adult body, depending on gender and size, will store between 1,200 and 2,000 calories worth of carbohydrate. Now, this is why this is important. That's about a 2 or 3 hour moderate training session. So you go out for a bike ride, a hike, like whatever, at moderate, not high, not low, moderate, you're only going to have enough gas in your tank, carbohydrates, to fuel that. But that's why we don't want to get in that cyclical pattern of just feeding carbohydrate because it's a losing battle. Whereas, in contrast, most of us non-professional athletes will have upwards of 80,000 calories of fat stored in our body. You literally plenty have days and days of fat reserves that you could just go on if you teach your body how to burn it.
Oh yeah. Well, so I mean, I've heard of people doing like 30-day fast, and I even read a story of a guy did like a 400-day fast. If you've got enough body fat, you can go a long time without eating.
Yeah.
But what you're saying is that you can exercise and burn that fat. at a performance level, right? I mean, you said 87% was like a peak you saw. That's an incredibly high level of effort. That's not my max heart rate, right, but that's a level of effort that's very hard.
Yeah.
You know, I couldn't do that for 3 hours.
Right.
You know, unless I had rests in between or something.
Yeah.
So you can learn, you're saying, you can learn to burn fat while you're exercising and not have to eat much and be healthy metabolically. And you get the side benefit of you burn off all that extra fat that you're carrying around and you look better.
Yeah.
Hey,
yeah.
Win.
You know, you put it like that, I'm sold.
I'm sold myself. My gosh, this is why I want to talk. All right. So I thought it would be interesting for you I've heard you say that you find three types of people in the metabolic efficiency testing results.
Yeah.
Why don't you tell us a little about that?
Yeah, so there's basically from the test that I created, there's really only three levels of metabolic efficiency. So there's level 1, 2, and 3. Level 1 is you are a sugar burner always. Like, it doesn't even matter, even at rest. Now, actually, I didn't even talk about that, because part of the testing is actually done. I separate it during rest. So you'll sit or lay down for 15, 20 minutes. You'll do what's called a resting metabolic rate, of which we also measure what is called substrate oxidation. Fancy term for just carbohydrate and sugar burning, basically, right?
So you're catching the exhale
exactly
from their mouth and nose, and you've got a machine that can measure the level of CO2 that's in there, and that somehow can tell you how much fat versus carb that is being burned.
Yeah, so in exercise physiology terms, it's looking at the respiratory quotient, or more importantly, the respiratory exchange ratio, RER, and that is just the relationship of O2 consumed over CO2 produced. And yes, to your point, someone will wear a mask or a mouthpiece that is hooked up to a metabolic cart. That's what's measuring and analyzing all this. And through just analyzing breathing and through physiological equations that the metabolic cart has, we know exactly the percentage of fat and carbohydrate you're burning at rest. Now, this level 1 usually is those people who are just sugar burners all the time, even at rest. That is an issue for health, because if you are burning more sugar or carbohydrate at rest, your body is pretty much going down the road of uncontrolled glucose, uncontrolled insulin, possible pre-diabetes, right? That is not a good thing from a health perspective. But after the resting test, we move them to either a treadmill or a bike, and then we do the exercise test. And this is where a lot of the levels start to kind of hash out. Like I said, that first level is that person starts off, even at the resting state, starts off burning a lot of carbohydrate, and they end burning a lot of carbohydrate. So they never cross. You alluded to that, where carbohydrate and fat lines cross. They will never cross because they are so inefficient at burning fat. Their body only is good at using and burning carbohydrate. Those are the easy ones to fix from a diet perspective, from a nutrition perspective, super easy to fix. The level 2 is actually they have a cross. So maybe they're burning fat early on, like at low intensities, but then, you know, maybe a couple minutes in, then they start burning more carbohydrate somewhere in. So they still cross. So it kind of looks good, but it's not efficient still, because here's the thing, it's very similar to lactate threshold. If you have an identified cross, which I call the metabolic efficiency point, the goal is to move it to the right. That's number 1, similar to lactate threshold. And number 2, we want to open up the fat burning at lower to moderate intensities, because we want the body to burn more fat, right? So the level 2s, actually those guys and girls are a little bit harder, because you need to tweak, you need to do more finite changes to the nutrition. So the level 1 are usually the people who are eating very high carbohydrates, nutrition plans, lower protein, lower fat. The level 2, they're kind of balancing for the most part, like they're controlling their blood sugar, but you know, they don't do it that well yet. They're good at it, but they're not great at it, right? The level 3 are actually fascinating. I have not seen many of these. I've only measured a few. These are our ketogenic diet people and our low carb, high fat people. They actually, it's the exact opposite of level 1. They start out burning a ton of fat and actually never cross, because they do not have the, I call it physical fatigue versus nutritional fatigue. So let me put this into play. If you are following mostly a low-carb diet, you don't have a lot of carbohydrates coming in, you're not going to be able to satisfy super high intensities of exercise, let's just say over 87% heart rate, right? So you're going to be limited on the intensity of exercise. So as the test, which I did not describe, every 4 minutes, the intensity increases in the test because we're trying to challenge the body. As the intensity of the test increases, there's going to be a certain point where they just become physically fatigued because they've not been doing any type of high intensity training, because what limits them is not having enough carbohydrate to support the high intensity training.
Okay.
So it's kind of cool. You can lump everybody into one of these three categories. And there are certain dietary or exercise interventions based on each one.
I did the keto diet some years ago. I did it for 4 months and I loved it. I really did love it. But I felt exactly what you described. I had endless energy. Mm-hmm. I never got tired. I never got hungry. Yep. I could go ride my bike and I never brought food, you know, because I wasn't going to need any. I just knew it. But when I had to go uphill, I was living in Colorado at the time and I had to go uphill, my legs were dead. Yeah. I couldn't do it. I could not go uphill, you know, with any power. Yeah. So yes, I was burning fat the whole time. And when it came time to burn sugar, I couldn't do it. Yeah. And so that makes good sense. Yeah. So that's interesting. You know, I'm sure some of the people are thinking, what about lactate? Well, you know, where does lactate come into this thing? And so we probably should talk about that. I mean, when you're sitting, I've heard some people are, you know, their lactate is up, you know, when they get on the bike.
Right, right.
And that's probably a stress thing combined with maybe being a sugar burner. But you would think that you've got to have some fast twitch muscle fibers making that lactate, you know, not being able to do the complete burn of the glucose, and then not have, you know, a use for that lactate in the muscle. I guess maybe when you're getting on the bike, your slow twitch muscles aren't really doing anything yet. And so, you know, it's all being exported out into the blood. And so, you can measure, you know, so there's always some amount of lactate, but, you know, sure, suddenly there's a higher amount than you would expect. But normally what we understand is that when your lactate is really high, it's because you're making so much that even though your slow twitch muscle fibers are going all out, they can't use it all.
Right.
And so there's still a lot extra getting out into the blood and going to elsewhere in the body to be used as a fuel. How does that kind of work into this whole thing?
Yeah, it's interesting. Two things to remember. One is lactate is actually a byproduct of glycolysis. So, and that is the first step of metabolism in carbohydrate metabolism. So when you eat carbohydrate, carbohydrates go through this first process called glycolysis, and the two end products are lactate and pyruvate. Now, pyruvate goes into the Krebs cycle to give us ATP. Lactate can actually go through the Cori cycle to actually regenerate and actually give us energy. Like we can actually fuel off of some lactate. But to your point, yeah, there's a point where like you got too much in the bucket, like it's going to hold you back, right? So the interesting thing is early on when I was developing this was I wanted to see the relationship between like the lactate threshold, the point at which your body stops clearing lactate that well, which is what you were just talking about, and the metabolic efficiency point. And so I did a whole bunch of testing on that myself and other athletes, and I found that those two are actually fairly independent of each other. So you can't say, oh, I have a high lactate threshold, therefore I must be metabolically efficient or whatever. There's a very weak association with that. And only two athletes I've ever measured, and these were actually Olympic level athletes, endurance athletes, only two had both the metabolic efficiency point and the lactate threshold close together within about a stage, like a 4 minute stage, which was probably for them anywhere between 5 to 8 beats per minute in their heart rate. Everybody else, very, very distinct pattern of having lactate threshold is usually higher than the metabolic efficiency point if they're not controlling and optimizing their blood sugar.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. And it's just useful to know that just measuring your lactate is not enough. You can't understand your metabolic efficiency by understanding your lactate profile. Okay. So with the time that we have left, let's get into the what to do. What do we do? The older athlete, how do we make ourselves have a better utilization of fat while we're exercising and also while we're not exercising so that we can be healthier but we can also have better fitness when we are exercising and need to eat less food. When I used to ride, I'd have a little bag on my handlebars and I would constantly be eating little essentially jelly beans, all of the time. And it was like, that's so stupid. Why was I doing that? So tell it, what do we need to know?
Okay. So metabolic efficiency training is, think of this equation, 3/4 nutrition plus 1/4 exercise equals metabolic efficiency training. So I'm not going to discount exercise, but I'm not going to talk about it much because it's actually the easy part of this equation. The basic premise of exercise, using exercise to improve the body's ability to burn fat, is we exercise below your metabolic efficiency point.
So you need to know what that is to some extent.
Exactly. That's the sticky part. So if you don't know what it is, you can probably get pretty close if you're like in a zone 1, zone 2. Probably.
Well, but here's something I've heard. I bet you'll agree, but help me with this sort of rule of thumb. Err on the side of going too easy.
Totally.
If you're not sure, go too easy. Because if you're going a little too hard, now you're training your body to do the dumb thing that you don't want it to do.
That's 100%. I totally agree with you there. So maybe we change that to do more zone 1 training, which nobody likes to do, right?
Yeah.
So exercise aside, exercise does help, but we talked about that.
But before we go into the diet I do have a couple of points I'd like to get to, if possible.
Yeah.
The whole purpose, as I understand it, of the zone 2 is that you're trying to build up your mitochondria, right? The mitochondria are the things that are burning the fat.
Right.
And so you want more muscle that's type 1 muscle fiber, if that really matters, but the muscle fiber that's got more mitochondria, you want better mitochondria. And so you have to train your body. You have to signal to your body, hey, I need more of these guys. Mm-hmm. I'm burning a lot of oxygen and I want to burn fat. And these are the only way that I can do that. So I want to do a lot of this, longer endurance type work. But I've also heard that you need to do some high intensity some of the time. How does that work out?
Yeah, you absolutely do. I find a lot of athletes, especially if there's weight loss in there as the goal, that just doing a lot of lower intensity exercise doesn't cut it. Like, it'll still improve your mitochondrial density, which is what we want, but you need the high intensity exercise every so often to produce. I mean, the fast switch muscle fibers act very differently than the slow twitch, right? I actually find, again, I'm just picking on weight loss, body comp changes as an example, because that's the majority of athletes, mostly what they want most of the time. You need that balance. You will not succeed with just low intensity training. So from a physiological perspective, the fast twitch versus slow twitch, they're both interacting with the mitochondria, but we also need to also look at the energy expenditure association between those. We also need to look at, as we age, we also decrease fast twitch muscle fibers, which decreases our VO2 max. And everyone, this is fascinating to me, Joe, like a lot of older athletes, we all gravitate to slower endurance things, right? When in fact, we should be sprinkling some high intensity in there, because we need that not only for better fat burning, but also for better aging, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I know that you have mentioned in the past, and I think a little here, about the weight training. And maybe there's a benefit to that from this metabolic efficiency point. But one of the benefits is that I think that it is thought to help, these efforts where you're sort of going all out max effort helps with your testosterone production. And that is going to be helpful in a lot of ways. One of the ways is it helps in recovery. And the faster you can recover, the more you can do.
That's absolutely true. Yeah. In addition to that, for males out there with testosterone, because we know that decreases through the decades, but also remember, again, after the age of 40-ish, we start to lose muscle mass, right? It's called sarcopenia, the age-related loss of muscle mass. So if you are not stressing your muscles in some way, shape, or fashion, you're going to start losing muscle. And what do we know about that? Well, obviously, where are we more efficient at using and producing energy in the muscle, right? So that's another major issue with weight gain and body composition gain over the years, is that we're simply not paying attention to the muscle, which is the most metabolically active tissue in the body, maybe besides the brain, right?
Right, right, right. Okay, so let's get into the diet part of it, which is three quarters of the solution.
Three quarters of the solution. I've literally proved this, that you can do nothing with your exercise and put all your eggs in the basket of nutrition and become metabolically efficient. So, you know, if someone is time restricted or they just don't want to exercise that much, they just want to walk, like, that's cool, right? Absolutely. The good news about this is it is super easy to develop metabolic efficiency through changing your nutrition from a technical standpoint. From a psychological standpoint, it takes a little bit longer because here's the thing, Joe, and you know this, like when you went keto, when you change your nutrition, you're changing a behavior, and changing a behavior is difficult, right? Like, I can tell you what to eat, but left on your own, you'd be like, oh my gosh, this is so hard. I don't know if I want to do this. Like, our mind gets in the way. But literally, all we have to do, let's back it up to the most simplistic intervention that I've mentioned. Put carbohydrate, protein, and fat, although we're assuming fat is in protein, put those together in the right ratios at most of your meals and snacks, and you will regulate or optimize blood sugar, which teaches your body to burn more fat. So it is literally as easy, and I've got ratios that I can talk about, but because I did a lot of research on this to come up with these, you can look at these ratios of carb to protein, right? And I alluded to it earlier. The background of this whole thing that I'm going to introduce is I did a lot of research in when I say research, I'm not a PhD researcher. I'm talking about literature review research, right? So I looked at diabetes research way back when, and I noticed that diabetics, obviously we know, need to control their blood sugar very well for obvious purposes. I took that data because they were suggesting carbohydrate and protein shifts, and I put it into an athletic model, and I came up with my ratios, right? So the ratios are very simple. You can be quantitative in this and count. I'm not a big fan of counting calories or grams and macros, but hey, whatever floats your boat. I do more of a subjective, simple model, and I call it my hand model. And you probably have seen this in my book. I've got my new edition of my metabolic efficiency training book out. I explain this in detail, but basically, if you look at the size of your hand, and let me qualify, your hand is measured from your wrist to your fingertips. It's the entire hand. It's not a palm. It's not a thumb. None of that stuff, right? So at the very basic level, I am recommending, and you look at these ratios, there's four ratios. Two are inside the bell-shaped curve and two are outliers. I don't recommend the outliers. Here are the outliers. One hand of carbohydrates to one hand of protein is probably, we talk about food here in a second. I know we'll go fast here. That's probably the best ratio to optimize your blood sugar. But that, because it will keep you so full for so long, you risk not eating enough. So you could actually get into what is called low energy availability. And that's a scary thing for a lot of people, right? So that's one outlier.
Yeah. Now, if somebody's riding their bike 20 hours a week, that's a consideration. For me, that's no problem.
Yeah. Looking at activity level and all that stuff. Yeah, absolutely. But you're just not going to get enough calories there to support exercise. The other outlier is 4-to-1. So four handfuls of carbohydrate to one handful of protein. That is in another extreme, which is why it's an outlier. Maybe we use that post-exercise to kind of fill up your gas tank or carbohydrate tank super fast. But I rarely recommend either of those. Where I go is right in the middle, bell-shaped curve, 95% of the time, where most of us should sit, is between eating for meals, two handfuls of carbohydrate to one handful of protein, or if you're in a heavy training phase, three handfuls of carbohydrate to one handful of protein. Both of those, which I call 2-to-1 or 3-to-1, carb to protein, both of those will optimize your blood sugar still. It's just a matter of if you need extra carbohydrates due to the energy expended based on your training load. And that's where the whole beauty of periodizing your nutrition comes into play.
Okay. And so if you are looking to get a weight loss benefit from this, then fewer hands of carbs will help you to get there. And if you find that you're losing too much weight, add more hands of carbs.
Spot on. Yeah. And you can fudge a little bit more protein. Like, you can go up to maybe 1.5 hands of protein, but you just need to kind of feel that out a little bit. See, it's more of N-of-1 there.
All right. And then as far as like how much protein, I think you have recommended sort of the normal athlete levels of protein, but you want to mention it?
Well, yeah, there are differences in athlete levels and, normal, I don't even so want to say normal personal levels. Like our government is ridiculous in the protein recommendations. They're so low, it's not even funny. This is why I actually developed the hand model, Joe, because doing this research, most of the time, as long as you get enough protein to fill your hand, that is the amount of grams of protein you need for muscle health, brain health, body composition, all that stuff. So I could throw out a number, which I will. For meals, it's usually 30 to 50 grams of protein per meal. Okay. But listen, everyone's different. Everyone has different sizes. I'm not going to tell maybe a small petite female that she needs 50 grams of protein for a meal.
Sure.
And I might not tell a really large gentleman that he needs 30, right? And that's why the hand model actually works really well, because the hands are
bigger.
Usually,
guy, bigger hands.
Exactly. More nutrients needed. Yeah.
All right. And so you talked about periodization, and let's get into that a little bit.
Yeah.
I think that you mean that like around your exercise, when you eat during the day, and then maybe you also mean like over time. I'm not sure.
Yeah. So nutrition periodization is basically aligning your nutrition to support your physical training goals for exercise. Okay. So as I talked about, training goes down, nutrition has to change. Training goes up, nutrition has to change. Based on circadian rhythm, it really kind of comes down to blood sugar regulation. So what we know in healthy adults, non-disease state adults, our blood sugar actually ebbs and flows about every 3 to 4 hours. So circadian rhythm-wise, that's when the body is needing sustenance. It's just whether we're listening to it or not, right? That also changes with age, right? As we become older, we actually, this is a whole different podcast for the master's athlete in nutrition, but we actually usually decrease our caloric intake, which is a little bit scary at times, because if we're as master's athletes, if we're decreasing our caloric intake, that also means we're eating less protein. That is usually not a good thing, because we're trying to fight that age-related loss of muscle mass also. So we have a couple cards stacked against us, but that's where the periodization comes into play is, maybe you're strength training. Maybe you do more protein pre and post weightlifting, right? So you can kind of sandwich these nutrients at different times of the day to have maximum benefits.
And is there, like fasting or intermittent fasting a part of this is for teaching your body to burn fat?
You're going to go down that road, huh? Yeah. Listen, when you fast, you do teach your body to burn more fat, 100%. That, obviously, that's what, but there are some really, I think when I talk about fasting or intermittent fasting, I kind of qualify it based on age group first, and then gender second. And again, this is a whole different topic, but I will say this, if you're going to ask me, does intermittent fasting improve metabolic efficiency? Yes, it does. I have some challenges with that if someone is training, actively training for events, because if you're fasting, you're basically negating or deleting a meal out of the day. So you're reducing your caloric intake, which could affect your performance training or your physiological adaptation response from training. Now, if you're not training for something, I mean, I might be able to have a more logical conversation about like, when intermittent fasting would work. Like if you're not training for events and you want to like push your breakfast from 7 a.m. to 10 a.m. and you're not skipping anything else, I probably don't have a problem with that. But we have to put context into that situation.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people, they get to, into their 50s and 60s and they're not racing anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe they are training for like a Grand Fondo or, cycling camp or something that they're going to do. And so maybe it does come into play. But for a lot of people, for me in particular, since I'm the host, I'm just sort of training for my pleasure.
Yeah.
I like it.
For life.
And I'm also trying to be healthy. And so I'm trying to get the maximum benefit out of marrying those two things together. And so fasting is a part of what I do. First of all, I do it every single day, right? Yeah. I stop eating at some point and I don't eat for a while. Until the next day. Now, I tend to eat breakfast every day, whether I'm going to work out that morning or not. And I've been thinking, gosh, you know what? Maybe if I don't exercise in the morning, maybe I could skip my breakfast. Yeah. Or maybe I should be fasted while I exercise to train my body to have to rely on the fat burn. And then I can refeed afterwards to sort of, lower the stress from that experience.
Yeah, and there's a lot of logic in that, especially if that workout is not high intensity. And that's the only thing is of concern. If it's high intensity and you fast before it, you're not going to be able to achieve high intensity because you don't have a lot of stored carbohydrate stores. But yeah, if it's aerobic based, absolutely. I mean, that's a great potential reason to not eat beforehand if you're not hungry. Like, you don't want to force it, right?
Yeah. Well, and I guess you've got to be more worried than I do about telling people to do things that they're going to hate.
Yeah.
I personally actually like needing to do things that I hate to do, right? Freezing cold showers. Let me tell you, I hate that, but I make myself do it. So doing a fasted workout, that I'm not used to doing that, but I'm going to do it, and I'm going to get the pleasure of suffering. Okay. So we are out of time. And so I wanted to give you a couple of minutes to tell us how to find you online. You know, people can maybe figure out how to find you because maybe they're in Colorado like you are, or people you have trained, and then we can wrap up.
I think the easiest way is to go to my website. So it's energyperformance.com, and it's actually spelled a little differently. So it's energperformance.com. I have so many great resources on there. You can go to the Energy Performance YouTube channel. Actually, I would highly recommend that and subscribe to it, because every week I do an Ask Energy. So I have athletes ask me questions, and I video my responses. So I provide the video responses. And, you know, like the last one I did is, how much sodium do I really need when I'm training, right? So they're like fun little question and answers. But yeah, I think that's probably the easiest way. I'm all over social, but if you just go to energyperformance.com, you can start getting a lot of great resources and then kind of branching out from there.
Well, that's great. I'll get that in the show notes. And just to let everybody know, you actually have written two books that I wanted to point out. One was on... you've written a lot of books, actually, and a couple of them were on this topic, but you've also written books on sodium and on caffeine. And I'll bet you a lot of people would be interested in that one.
Oh, those are popular. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll get the links to that in the show notes. Bob, hey man, thank you very much. This was very helpful to me. I appreciate it.
Oh, Joe, it's been my pleasure. I look forward to hopefully being back on in the future.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely. We'll have you on. Have a great day.
Thank you.
Alrighty. Bye-bye. Thank you so much for joining my conversation with Bob Seawahar. I hope you learned as much as I did, and if you want to find more information about Bob, check out the show notes.